There are professionals who predict the future, and I don't mean astrologers. I'm talking about people you and I consult all the time. Weather forecasters, stock market analysts, Nate Silver. They make a living using complex algorithms to analyze reams of data. So what if I told you that untrained, non-expert, ordinary people can out-predict them? Philip Tetlock is a political psychologist who spent 20 years studying expert judgment. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with him about what he calls super forecasting, the art and science of prediction.
Phil, you say we are all forecasters. In what way?
Well, it's very hard to do anything in life in a rational way without trying to estimate what will happen if you go down one path or another. If you marry one person or another, you take one job or another, you move to one city or another, you vote for one candidate or another, on and on. We're basing those decisions on implicit or explicit guesses about what's going to happen if we do something. And the premise of this entire project is that we're better off being more explicit than implicit about the guesses we're making.
So we can actually learn to make better guesses. I mean, this is a talent we can cultivate.
That is the core issue that the U.S. intelligence community wanted to study 5 years ago when they launched this series of forecasting tournaments, is probability estimation of messy real-world events, a skill that can be cultivated and is worth cultivating.
So are the quote experts, are they really that good at making predictions?
It really depends on the type of time frame and type of question we're talking about. In the early work, we were asking the subject matter experts to look far out into time, 3, 5, 10 years out, and it's very hard to beat the dart-throwing chimpanzee when you're trying to predict that far out. In the later work, we were looking at forecasts in a more short-term horizon, 3 to 18 months roughly, and that turns out to be sort of a Goldilocks zone in which you can identify talent.
Mm-hmm. So you and your wife and research partner, Barbara Mellers, started something called the Good Judgment Project a few years ago. What were you trying to do with this project?
Well, about 6 years ago, my wife and I were still on the faculty at the University of California, Berkeley, and we received a visit from three gentlemen from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and they informed us of their plan to run a competition, a series of forecasting tournaments, and Barbara and I were in charge of one of the research teams. There were five major research universities and consultancies that were in competition with each other. The intelligence committee was in the role of the pitcher. It was throwing questions at us, and we were in the role of the batters. We were trying to hit the questions out of the park without striking out. 4 years and 500 questions later, the Good Judgment Project did emerge as the winner of the forecasting tournament. In fact, we'd won the forecasting tournament pretty decisively after the first 2 years. So some of the teams were consolidated after that point. But the basic idea is, can you get better at this?
So these are all, I mean, they're difficult questions, but they're all real-world questions. You're grappling with the stuff out there that decision-makers have to deal with.
We're out in the wild. These aren't artificial laboratory problems with artificial laboratory tricks. This is the real thing.
So is this a matter of, I mean, people who are super smart with mathematics, I mean, sort of being able to do probabilities and all of that? Is that the key here?
Well, it doesn't hurt, but it's certainly not a necessary condition for being a super forecaster. We have a lot of super forecasters who don't know a lot of math or statistics. They do, however, tend to be numerate. They're comfortable with numbers, but they don't have to be mathematically profound.
When you say they're good with numbers, I mean, they're good at assessing the odds. I mean, it's like, so okay, there's a 60% chance that this thing is going to happen. I mean, they sort of have that sense of probability.
Exactly. So in the book, we report an interview with the chief risk officer of a hedge fund in New York City, Aaron Brown, who also happens to be a very serious poker player, a world-class poker player. And he said the way you can tell the difference between a world-class player and a talented amateur is that world-class players can more reliably tell the difference between 60-40 bets and 40-60 bets. And then he paused and said, oh, it's more like 55-45, 45-55. They think it's a skill worth cultivating, and they become quite adept at distinguishing more degrees of uncertainty than most human beings think it's worthwhile to distinguish. There's no real argument, I think, in most people's minds that's possible in poker, that you're better off over the long term. betting on the person who has the better appreciation of probability, even though that you know that person won't win every hand. You know that in the long run, the odds will favor a person who is better at estimating the odds. The question is, can you also do better on questions such as whether there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or whether there'll be a violent clash between China and Japan in the East China Sea, or things that have the potential to alter world history?
Right. Well, it seems like those are not ultimately questions where you can really assign probabilities. I mean, that's sort of informed analysis, trying to figure out the shape of world events.
Well, that's exactly the attitude that many people in the intelligence community had to the proposal to run a forecasting tournament. The National Intelligence Council at the time was distinguishing 5 degrees of uncertainty in its national intelligence estimates. It could say that things were very likely, quite likely, unsure, quite unlikely, very unlikely. 5 degrees of uncertainty, that's it. No numbers, just subjective assessments along that scale. So the question was, could we do better than that? Could we reliably make more subtle distinctions among degrees of uncertainty than that 5-level scale that was being used by the National Intelligence Council? And the answer, I mean, there's a scientific answer to this, and that is our best forecasters and our best algorithms and our best teams were able to distinguish somewhere between 15 and 20 degrees of uncertainty.
Wow.
and they were also able to outpredict intelligence analysts with access to classified information.
You brought together people who are not professionals in these areas, and you're pitting them against the people in the U.S. intelligence agencies, and your forecasters are doing better?
Right. Well, in fairness to everybody here, we should say that the 500 questions asked were very heterogeneous. So no one individual is going to be an expert on any more than a fairly small fraction of the questions. I mean, there's nobody who's an expert on Sino-Japanese naval conflict and Eurozone financial stability and H5N1, although simultaneously. So everybody, to some degree, is having to function as a talented amateur or an improviser in response to the questions that are being pitched at them any given week.
So what did your team, why was it so effective? Why was it better than the quote, professional forecasters?
I think it comes back to this core idea that our forecasters really were curious whether this was a skill that could be cultivated and was worth cultivating, so they worked really hard at it. A lot of very thoughtful people inside the U.S. intelligence community quite understandably had the attitude that you just expressed, which is, hey, yeah, sure, odds matter in poker, but how can you possibly assess the odds of whether Greece is going to leave the Eurozone in the summer of 2015? You can't go back in your time machine to the summer of 2015 and rerun history 100 times and see how often Greece left the Eurozone and say, oh, well, it's 14% of the time. That was the probability. You can't do that. And so therefore, most people have a mental block and they say, look, probability estimation of those events is therefore impossible. But that's a little too extreme. It's true you can't go back in history and rerun it and observe the distribution of outcomes, but there are things you can do. You can say, how likely is Greece to leave the Eurozone? Given that, the weighted average of our best forecasters at this juncture in time is 14%, and we know that those forecasters are very well calibrated, so that on average, when they say events of this sort are 14% likely, they tend to occur about 14% of the time. So you can do that. And that is a lot better than nothing.
So if we just play out this one example for a moment, I mean, will Greece leave the Eurozone or, I mean, by a particular date, what would be some factors that would go into making that guess?
Well, I'm not a super forecaster, so you should really be interviewing the super forecasters about how they work their magical forecasting operations. But they're not magical at all. They're very public and transparent. So on the Grexit question, I think they might start by asking, how often do you see forced currency conversions in international economics? Not very often. How many prior crises of Greek exit have there been, and how have they resolved themselves? Have any other countries ever left the Eurozone? And if Greece did leave the Eurozone, do they have a viable plan? Or was the Greek leadership just bluffing? Do they have a plan B? And if they don't have a plan B, that's certainly a sign that they may well be bluffing, which they turned out to be.
Right. So are there certain character traits, personality traits that go into the making of a super forecaster?
Well, the most important one, I think, is this attitude that this is a skill that's worth cultivating and I'm going to work at cultivating it. So it's a gritty determination to get better at this. And it requires a certain amount of grit. I mean, it requires grit to learn how to play the piano, But if you had to try to learn to play a piano in which a demon comes into your house every couple of months and changes the location of the keys, it would be pretty exasperating. So learning to forecast world politics is a bit like that, because you can get very good at predicting patterns in a given year or in a given region, and then suddenly the rules may shift. So you have to relearn things fast. And that's something super forecasters are just willing to do. I mean, they know that they're going to be wrong, sometimes very wrong, sometimes.
So they have to be very open-minded. They have to be willing to change their mind.
They have to be willing to change their minds. And they have to be willing, after reality knocks them on the chin, they have to be willing to get up and dust themselves off and get back into it.
Philip Tetlock teaches politics and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and the Wharton School of Business. He's the co-author, along with Dan Gardner, of Super Forecasting: The Art and Science of Prediction. Steve Paulson talked with him.